Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity, set up chores, and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Empire.
Called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are.
It's a serious question.
I appreciate your passion. I share it. I've addressed this question. I've addressed my personal feelings.
And I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news.
You're listening to Just Ask the Question, Adventures in Reporting with your host, Brian Karam.
Hi, and welcome back to Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, and today with me is a fellow member of the White House Press Corps and an author, Charisse Jatte, whose new book, The Useful Idiot, will be coming to you soon. And we're going to talk a little bit about that and, of course, about covering the American president, the useful idiot, Donald Trump. Charisse will join us when we come back. Three, two, one. Hi, and welcome back to Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, and with me today is Charisse Jatte, the senior White House correspondent for the Huffington Post, author, and of course, a fellow compatriot in the White House press briefing room. So Charisse, you got a book coming out called The Useful Idiot, and to just, since the title of this, I can share with you, I took the title of this podcast from Helen, who once told me the first day I was in the White House briefing room, she said, Brian, it doesn't matter if they answer the question, doesn't matter what the answer is, just ask the question. So, that way they can't deny that the issue has been before them. So right. That's kind of been my guiding principle ever since. And with Helen and Sam as my mentors, I've tried to have fun in the White House. So to just ask the question, why'd you name your book The Useful Idiot?
Well, because as hard as it may be to believe for 49 to 70% of the country, depending on what poll you look at, there were some people who actually wanted Trump to get elected, badly wanted him to get elected, because of certain things they thought they were going to get from him, right? And among them were evangelical Christians who, as a bloc, have voted Republican over the years, who were kind of skeptical of Trump until he basically was extremely transactional, far more so than anybody else who's been running for the White House since I've been paying attention, and saying, all right, look, I will give you exactly the judges you want. Here's my list. And he put out the list. He literally put out a list of the people he would draw from, you know, for the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court. Not only that, he said to the Federalist Society and its allied groups, look, I don't really care who the judges are going to be. Just, you know, give me the names and I'll approve them. And that's exactly what has happened, right? And so, right. And that would not have happened with a Jeb Bush or a Marco Rubio or a John Kasich. Granted, most of the names would have been in
common. Still be on the list, yeah.
Right, yeah. I mean, there are very few people that the Federalist Society were going to put up that Jeb Bush would say no to, and vice versa. I do think that Jeb or Kasich or Rick Perry, any of those guys, would be a little bit more hesitant about putting people who are rated unqualified by the ABA,
yeah,
you know, on a federal bench, which is literally has been happening under President Trump. So, you know, that's... Those are some of the folks who saw Trump as a useful idiot before the election. Also, there was Vladimir Putin saw him as a useful idiot, not necessarily to win. No one thought he was going to win, not even them. But he was gonna wreak chaos, and that was a useful goal in and of itself, you know, for the Russians and for Putin. Wrecking our alliances with NATO nations, with the European Union, with Japan, with South Korea, you name it. All the damage that the president has done with those relationships inures to the benefit of Russia and Putin.
Right.
And so, you know, he's incredibly useful in terms of advancing Putin's goal. As to our own Americans' goals, well, you know, that's another issue entirely.
Why now, and what's the book about? Why do you think it's important now, and what is it about?
I'll tell you why I really got serious about writing this. And as I write in the preface, I didn't really want to write this book. All right. I mean, I love writing novels. Okay. Because in the end, you can make the bad guy get his comeuppance, right? You can make right. sure that a tiger shark eats him. You can make sure that he has a bad encounter with a annoyed badger, you know, as I put in the preface. In nonfiction, you write what real life is there. And that's not always fun. And it's a lot like the day job. And so there's no real getting away from that when you're doing this. I will say that my two previous nonfiction books, the biographies of Jeb Bush and Bob Graham, both Florida politicians, I didn't hate writing. I enjoyed writing those two because I admired both of the individuals. I personally didn't agree with Jeb Bush's view of the world, but he worked hard. He's smart. He didn't insult people all the time. He took the job seriously. And so in the end, it was, you know, it was a good experience to write that. This is very different. You know, I did not know anything about Donald Trump at all until 2006, when I first saw him at a fundraiser in Florida for Charlie Crist, who was running for governor at the time. And he talked about the ceiling moldings and the tile he just put in and the hangings that he'd gotten. And look at that chandelier. Do you know how much that chandelier cost? And he went on for like 20 minutes describing the room we were standing in at Mar-a-Lago and then about how great his television show was. And everyone in the country was watching his TV show. And Charlie, you've watched my show too, right? He, you know, and Chris just nodded. And Chris never said one word during that entire thing. Now, you know how it goes at fundraisers.
Yes.
Normally, you know the guy introduces the candidate and then the candidate gives a speech and so on. None of that happened. It was just Donald Trump talking about his renovations at Mar-a-Lago and about his television show and Charlie Crist just standing there nodding. And I thought, what the hell was that? And I thought, well, at least I never have to deal with this person again, you know, because that's, you know.
I had a similar, I got to share a similar, I was doing a piece in New York for America's Most Wanted, and Trump was coming out of Trump Tower at the time, and I needed to get a soundbite from him and that's the only time I talked to him prior to him being, you know, running for office or you know, coming into the forefront politically. And I needed a, you know, basically 30 seconds of sound, and I got a 20-minute dissertation on the price of real estate in Manhattan, which sure. had nothing to do with the story.
Right. But you're a better person for it, though, aren't you, having learned that?
I left that with this. I remember turning to the crew going, what the hell was that?
Yeah.
And praying I never had to deal with him again.
Yeah. Yeah, but the thing is, right, I mean, so, and then when he runs for president, I thought, well, maybe he's more of a serious person than I gave him credit for back when I saw him. And then I saw his speech as he came down the escalator. And I literally thought this was a joke, you know, that a lunatic had written this and given it to him just as for publicity's sake and went to his first event in New Hampshire. And it was the same thing. He just insulted all the reporters there. He read off his polls. That was all. That was his campaign. And I thought, you know, this is absurd. This is not going anywhere, and this is going to collapse. And as soon as the other candidates get serious, that'll be that. And you know, and I can cover Jeb and Rubio and the others not have to pay any attention to this guy. In fact, I had to twist the arm of my editor, National Journal, where I was at the time, to persuade her to let me stay an additional day to do Trump's event because it was seen as such a ridiculous thing that why am I wasting company money on this man? And I told her, look, it's $100 extra to change the ticket, another 150 for, you know, hotel. And I said, fine, but this is the last story we're ever doing on this.
You know. So you thought.
Right, exactly.
Little did we all know. So that's why you wrote it. What's it about? What's the story about? This is the first one, I think, the first book to drop about Trump during COVID. So
absolutely,
that's of great interest to me. But what's it about?
It's about, number one, his utter mismanagement of the coronavirus, complete. From the first day to what's going on right now, he has, in turn, ignored the intelligence. I mean, here's the thing. You remember like a year ago when the hurricane was coming up the Florida coast and he decided to put Alabama into the mix. Remember that? Right. So he basically, for fun almost, drew like Alabama into the episode for no good reason at all. And the thing was, what the White House people thought, it was a big joke. They thought, isn't this crazy? This is just getting under the press's skin. It's just triggering them. Isn't this wonderful and funny? I remember one aide even had a chart of the hurricane trapping map. And
Hogan was it? Trump, yeah, Hogan. I'll name him. I've written about this.
Yeah,
Hogan and thought it was hilarious.
Exactly. And my thinking then, in which I included in an essay I wrote about Trump's dishonesty, which came out back in January, was, you know, a hurricane is one thing because we have satellites, we have images of where the hurricane is, where we have trained meteorologists who are the lead on this, and people listen to them, unless you're out of your mind and listen to the president's, you know, Twitter forecast instead. But we have 6, 7, 8 hurricanes every year that may hit us, come close to hitting us, actually hit us. What happens when there's a real crisis that only the president can deal with? That the one person in America who gets to the president's daily brief every day, and that information is in there. What happens when Trump has a situation like that? When there isn't a national a hurricane center as a fallback, there isn't, you know, FEMA to automatically jump in.
Oh, I can answer that. I take no responsibility at all. That's where we landed.
That is exactly where we landed. So that's why I started getting, you know, all the books that are out there are great from describing the infighting in the White House and you know, Trump's core nature, et cetera, but what was missing was this matters. Man, this stuff matters to what's happening to actual people. And the day he went out there and said that, you know, we really ought to look into injecting the disinfectants directly into the lungs and, you know, get that very powerful light into the body somehow. And we'll have medical doctors look into, I thought, you know what, this is beyond, this is insane. This is literally insane. And, you know,
well, look where we are now. He's defending the actions of a 17-year-old white boy with a gun, unregistered, acting as a vigilante, allegedly murdering two people. Now, if that's not going to empower vigilantism across this country against people of color or people whose last names are Karam or Date, I don't know what it is. It's frightening to me how I always thought. You know, I said were you there for the first press briefing with Sean?
I was pool that day. It was
I was there that day. When they came out and said the size of the crowd is not, I knew exactly where this administration was going. And I told everyone who would listen, I go, you cannot believe a word that's come out of them about anything ever.
Yeah.
And it's gone. And they've been true to form ever since. If it's he's going to lie, and he's so desperate, I say, but this is in my current column, I say he's so desperate for affection, he'd give the devil a reach around. I mean, he doesn't care if this is a vigilante or if it's a QAnon supporter. He yearns and craves someone to like him.
That's exactly it. I mean, you don't send love letters to the murderous dictator of North Korea. That's not a thing.
Right.
That has normally happened in United States foreign policy, right? I'm just saying, you know, that's.
I know. That's, yeah. I forgot about that one. It's the fresh atrocity of the day. All the, and that's one thing. The news cycle for this administration turns over so quickly because he's trying to obfuscate so much that he's, you know, don't look at the right hand, look at the left hand. By the way, look at the right hand, don't look at the left hand. And so it's a chaos of churning of endless sound bites. And so you forget one atrocity trying to cover. I've got probably, I keep a list of questions and issues, and I've got easily 1,000 items on that list of stuff I've never gotten answers to, or they've completely forgotten and swept under the rug.
Right.
So in your book, tell me where what you touch on.
Well, obviously the coronavirus pandemic, the president's response to it is what makes this absolutely topical. But this didn't happen by accident, right? I mean, Donald Trump did not appoint himself president. There were 63 million human beings who decided, after seeing Trump behave the way he behaves for a year and a half, that, yeah, I'm going to put this guy in charge of the nuclear codes and put this person and make him responsible for the armed forces of the United States, for the clean running of our government, and I'm okay with that. And, you know, that's on us, man.
Yes, it is.
In a representative democracy, we ultimately are responsible for the stuff that happens. And we collectively are responsible for this.
Yeah. So, I don't say he's not a cause. He's a symptom of the problems in the U.S., I think.
Yeah.
To Reagan.
Right. I think that part of it is because we are such a big country, because we have such a, you know, people will flip out when I say this, but we have such a non-corrupt, well-functioning bureaucracy. A lot of times it doesn't matter who the president is, right? I mean, when George W. Bush was elected in 2000 and Al Gore was the opponent, the Republic was not in danger, regardless of who was elected, right? I think a lot of people say, well, Gore's probably would have been a better president, probably would have handled 9/11 with more maturity, possibly. I think the same could have been said in 2008. You know, McCain and Obama are very different people. The Republic wasn't in danger, regardless. And this was the first time in my lifetime, right? The first time, certainly, since I've been president, since I've been a journalist, that who became president or who became governor of a state mattered immensely. Right. And why this wasn't obvious to everybody,
there's a book in that, Demystifying Why People Like Donald Trump. Yeah. And I have relatives and in-laws, and man, they swear it's a cult in some regards. And they don't. Right. I when you try to bring facts into it, sometimes they will acknowledge the facts, but still in their mind will justify Donald Trump, even though it stands contrary to the facts that they know exist.
Yeah, and I get into that quite a bit in the history of how the Republican Party got to be where it is. You know,
where do you maintain that it is?
Well, in the 1930s and 1940s and 1950s, the Republican Party was the party of desegregation and bringing civil rights to African Americans after the Civil War. Abraham Lincoln died because he ended slavery and freed African Americans in this country. So
Teddy Roosevelt was a progressive.
Absolutely. So there's what happened in 1954 with the Brown v. Board of Education. That was the first shot in the next 20 years or so. There were a lot of Southern Democrats who were incredibly agitated by that ruling. We had the invention of these all-white Christian schools in the South. And over the next 20 years, as LBJ pushed the Civil Rights Act, the trend of
Dixiecrats went to the Republican Party.
Well, yeah. And they didn't just go. Richard Nixon, like, invited them, wanted them. Right? This was the Southern strategy. This was what Kevin Phillips wrote about. And
exactly.
Yeah, right? And so –
I mean,
and,
that was not Eisenhower's Republican Party.
No, that absolutely was not.
I think that with Goldwater, it began kind of with Goldwater. Nixon solidified it with his Southern strategy. And then Ronald Reagan drove it home and set the table that gave us Donald Trump.
Right. And, but the difference there is that every single one of them, Nixon included, understood that this was a constituency to pander to come election time, and then kind of pretty much ignore after that, because what they wanted was not what a decent society wants, right? I mean, they literally wanted to resegregate public schools.
Yeah.
That is what they wanted during the 1960s. That is what they wanted in 1968. That is why a bunch of them actually voted for George Wallace. And so the Republican, the mainstream Republican Party, winked and nodded and dog whistled at their prejudices. And then once they got into office, kind of said, well, you know.
I'll take an issue. I think Reagan was the first to begin to pay attention to him. He not only empowered them, but some of the things he did when he became president did pander to them, not to the extent that the Bushes, well, not the first Bush, but the second Bush, and now Trump have pandered to them. But I think he cracked the door open for that. I mean, remember Bitburg, and when he went to Germany, and
right.
he said some of the things that Trump has been famous. You know, not everybody's a bad person. And I mean, that comes, there were a lot of Reaganisms in some of the stuff that Trump says. So I agree with you to a point. I mean, I think Nixon used everybody. So he didn't give a shit. But he did know had an idea of what a decent society was. I wouldn't say that he empowered.
Well, it was Nixon's DOJ that went after Donald Trump and his dad.
Yeah.
For refusing to rent apartments to black people. So, you know, Nixon created the
EPA.
Yeah, he created the EPA.
Yeah.
I mean, so there was a lot of progressive and mainstream ideas in that Nixon White House. I will say that one anecdote that I have in the book in that chapter is I was at the Iowa State Fair back in 15, right? When all the Republicans were going out there and they were going in Des Moines Fairgrounds, they're going to the Butter Cow exhibit and eating all kinds of fried nonsense and so on.
And they're done that.
As one does at the Iowa State Fair. And Trump came and, you know, gave his helicopter rides. And I thought, well, this is novelty. This is people like him because he's unusual and he's giving helicopter rides and this will fade. And then I was in that line where people drop their corn kernels, right, to vote. This is their straw poll that they do to determine who's going to win the Iowa State Fair, you know, straw poll. And I was just kind of overhearing these people who are going to vote for Trump. And you know what they talked about? Getting the illegals out of our country. And the reason was if they stay, their kids are U.S. citizens, you know, and if that happens, then they're just going to drag all their family over into the states, and then Democrats will win every single election, and we'll never have a Republican in the White House again. And it's them illegals that we need to stop, and those that are here we need to kick out. And Donald Trump is the only one who's got the guts to say that. So I'm writing all this down, listening to these guys. They don't know that I'm a reporter. I'm standing in the shade of a tree, right? And then after they go and vote, I run them down and say, hey, look, I saw that you just voted, and I think you voted for Trump. Could I talk to you? And they didn't want to give their names. And I asked them, you know, the basic things, where are you from, et cetera. And I asked them, well, why did you vote for Trump? And they said, oh, because he tells it like it is. You know, he's a good businessman. He's not going to be politically correct. And so, well, does illegal immigration have anything? What part does illegal immigration play in your decision making? Well, not really, not at all. You know, and they had just been talking about it. So this is the reality of a lot of core Trump supporters is that they do want the really xenophobic kind of get out of our country stuff that Donald Trump says openly.
Yes.
And he's the only one among the candidates who would do that.
Right. And then they lie on his lies.
And then when you've got 15 other people running, that gets you to 25-30% of the Republican electorate. That's enough.
That's all he needed.
Right.
There was something you said in the book. For starters, he only occasionally takes intelligence briefings. I'm going to take issue with that. I don't know that he's ever done that. I think he does, but occasionally. I think rarely. I mean, anymore. In the beginning, he was taking them regularly, but I have friends or sources in the intelligence community who say you can't even talk to the man, and he doesn't take these briefings anymore.
I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt that when they actually put it on the schedule, that he's at least made the motions of having one that day. Now, yeah. I've been keeping very careful track of this. I built a database going all the way back to the start of the administration. And as you say, there were typically three or four per week, and they're given, you know, on weekdays.
In the first year.
In the first 3 or 4 months. You know when it ended? It stopped happening on a regular basis the week that he fired Comey.
That's right.
Like within 2 days after that.
That's right. You're absolutely right. I've been keeping track of that as well. And I think you're right. It was Comey. I thought it was longer than 3 or 4 months. I thought it was close to the year. But seldom does he ever do a briefing. And I'll tell you what else is – the other thing that is noticeable to me, and they've tried to lie about it on a number of occasions, but the Marines don't lie. When that Marine Corps guard is out in front of the West Wing, the president is in the West Wing.
Correct.
When the Marine Corps guard is not there, the president is not there, no matter what they say to the contrary. And I confirm that with the Marines, who point blank told me he's lying. We can't say that openly, but he's lying. So if you, on days that I go to the White House, and I'm getting down there once a week now during COVID, seldom do you see a Marine Corps guard there.
That is correct. Yeah. And on days that I have pool, I'll be there at, 8:30, 8, 7, sometimes. And there's never a Marine, you know, in front of the West Wing at that time. No. And rarely is there one there before noon.
Yes. I mean, that's exactly right. Yeah, I can count on one hand the number of times in the last 6 months when there's been one there before noon. If there is one there before noon, that's usually because there's something public going on in the White House before noon. Otherwise, you're not going to see him.
He's in the residence watching television and tweeting.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's that simple. I mean, what you see is what you get. I mean, there's no big secret here. I mean, when you see him like live tweeting
on
Fox.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah.
There's a lot of denial, but what killed me was last Sunday, he's tweeting out, "We want God." While I know at the same time he's on the back nine at his own golf course.
Yes.
And so I was like, what are you looking for, God on the back nine? I mean, what do you mean we want God? You don't ever go to church. it's the hypocrite, the hypocrisy. We got to take a short break. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about the book. And of course, I really want to talk a little bit about covering this White House. So when we come back. Okay, here we go. In 3, 2, 1. Hi, I am your host, Brian Karam. The name of the show is Just Ask the Question. With me is fellow White House correspondent, Sharice Tate, who has a great book out. I confess, you sent me all of it. I've only gotten through 3 chapters because I've only had it a day. But I do love it. And the title of the book is The Useful Idiot. And there's really nothing more we could say about Donald Trump other than that. The subtitle is longer, but I like the title of the book. But I wanted to ask you, your experiences in the White House briefing room, how often are you getting there now?
I go only when I have pool, so once a month. And then I'm traveling once every 5 weeks or so, on the plane. So it's not that much anymore.
So the BS, but you've made your time count. The last time you were in the White House, you asked a question that only a few others of us have asked, and I like the way you framed it, and I love the question. Would you like to repeat it, or you want? I don't want to quote it, but I mean I will. But you said it, so I give it to you. What'd you ask him? For those who don't know,
I asked him, after 3.5 years, does he regret all the lying that he's done to the American people? And maybe he didn't hear or was...
I don't think he heard.
Ask me to repeat. I repeated it a little louder. Yeah. And then he asked me that who has done?
Yeah.
As if I'm...
Who the hell else? I'm covering you, pal.
So I made clear that, yes, in fact, I was asking you, sir, Mr. President, the lying that you've done. And then he decided he wanted to take a question about the payroll tax instead. And so that was that. Yeah.
He was nicer to you than I asked him that out on the South Lawn one day. But I preface it as saying, what do you say to your Democratic opponents who say you're an pathological liar?
Yeah.
And he looked at me and he goes, and I thought he was going to say F you, but he goes, fake news.
And then he went on.
It's not anything that he ever likes to address.
Well, let me say, I tried to ask that question about 4 or 5 months ago, and I made the mistake of prefacing it with, there's a new poll out that shows that your credibility is really bad. It is like down in the 20s or something. And as soon as I said the word poll, he jumped all over the question, right? Yeah. And he says, well, those are fake polls. I have much better polls, and I'm winning every single one of them, and Sleepy Joe Biden, and fake news, and 96% in the Republican Party. And then after about 3 or 4 minutes of just going on with that, he, you know, asked someone else for a nicer question. And so I learned from that, right? No preface. Just, well,
I've talked about that often with, and I remember John Decker and I had this conversation, and Peter Alexander and some of the other correspondents, when you're, and I think Blake at Fox, and we're out on the South Lawn. And I'm used to, if you're in a press briefing situation, being able to give a preface and context to your question, and a president having presence of mind enough to sit through 30 seconds.
Right.
But this president doesn't. And everything now is reduced to what you have to do on the South Lawn, which is ask a blunt question in 15 words or less and keep his attention and don't give him the trigger words that he desires. So he can.
Like poll.
Yeah, like poll. Right. Well, the other one is
right.
I've been trying to ask about bounties on American soldiers.
Yeah.
And the first time I asked that, I asked it about Russian bounties on him. Mm-hmm. And so he went off on, no one's been tougher on Russia, blah, blah. So he was able to, and then the second time I asked it, I took the word Russian out. And I just said, are you concerned about bounties on American soldiers? And I actually got more of an answer. So, you have to be wary of his trigger words so he doesn't go off and down his, path of destruction that he's.
But
that's our president. One of the things I wanted to ask you about being, so you're in there once a month or every 5 weeks traveling. That we have been criticized, the press has been criticized often for the way we cover this president. And I defend publicly, it's a very tough job to do, particularly during a COVID crisis where there are only 14 of us allowed in that briefing room. So you can't, when there's 75 or 80, when I was talking to Joe Lockhart about this and they have briefings, you're able to, reporters can triangulate and corner and cover each other. You know, like I could ask a question, you would follow up, someone else would follow up on you. And that's when Lockhart said he got really nervous, is when reporters who are smart started doing that. And you can't, it's harder to do it with a Kayleigh McEnany briefing because she's going to speak for 10 minutes. There are only 14 reporters there. Some of them are the younger reporters who don't have a whole lot of experience.
Right.
And then she'll take a question or two and she's going to kick it back to stop in at her, you know, her one stop at OANN or somebody that, or whoever else is Fox or somebody she knows she can count on for a decent question. So you're going to get in a 5 minute statement and then drop the mic and walk out. So it's harder for us to do the job. All of that being said, I've also said I don't think we've done a very good job covering this president and asking the hard questions. And you, as a member of the press in that briefing room, where do you fall on that?
Yeah, well, it's impossible, I think, to rely on asking questions and getting answers when the people you're asking them don't care whether they lie or not, right? I mean, that's the fundamental precept here is we count on the people we elect, the people who run the government, the people who serve the public by relaying the information from that government to tell the truth to the best of their abilities, right? And there used to be a sense of shame that if you lied, you were going to be humiliated and you would have to go apologize and explain why it is that you said this thing that was not true. You know, I remember in the Bush years, you know, and in the Obama years, when something was said that was incorrect, you know, from an official source, it would be bad, and they would worry about how to deal with it, and they would be upset that their credibility had been hurt. And there is none of that, none of that whatsoever right now. It's almost like a badge of honor that they've lied, and they've lied openly and gotten away with it. And what are you going to do about it? You know, and
how do you cover that?
Right. I mean, it's impossible. And the only way to cover it is to ignore it to the extent that you have other reporters covering things. And the Times does a fantastic job, so does the Post, covering the intelligence community and, you know, what's going on overseas and the State Department. And some of the best stories out of this administration have come from people who are covering DHS, you know, from Border Patrol, from things that are not coming out of the White House. And that is because all those agencies are subject to FOIA. The White House isn't, right? So I know for a fact, just doing the math, that millions of dollars of American tax money has gone into Donald Trump's pockets. Like by when he travels to Ireland to play golf at his own resort, there are a bunch of Secret Service agents who are staying with him. And they're charging top dollar, and we all collectively are paying. How much exactly? The White House won't say, right? So you've got to play this game, and we have to try to get that information from the State Department if it's overseas, or from the Secret Service, and they drag their feet on filling those records requests. They black out half the information because to protect their, you know, the people they're protecting. So, you know, it's we have a system where so much of it relies on the honor system, right? So much of it relies on wanting to do the right thing. That when you elect someone who doesn't care about that at all and staffs the White House with people who don't care about that at all, here we are.
Yeah.
We just had the Republican National Convention on White House grounds, okay? On White House grounds.
White House grounds with probably, what, maybe 1,000 violations of the Hatch Act, all those federal employees. I mean, everyone who took a ticket, everyone who
absolutely
who put a seat down, everyone who attended that was a federal employee, all of those are direct violations of the Hatch Act. And when I talked to Norm Eisen about it this week, I said, hey, you think anybody will ever be prosecuted for that? He goes, no, because this administration doesn't care. And and they have pigeonholed and forced people to violate Hatch Acts. You work for me, you show up. And so, you know, all those people have to show up.
Yeah, those chairs didn't arrange themselves, right? Out on the lawn.
They tried that once. It didn't work.
Yeah.
And so they placed all of us. I was there for that press briefing out on the White House lawn when they put 20 chairs in the Rose Garden right next to each other, and we just moved them.
Right.
It's like, hey, I love you, but 6 feet, baby.
Yeah.
I will take issue with, I think there has been, it was a notable exception. One person in this administration did apologize for something that was said, but it was because it was so egregious that I don't think that there was any way not to. And that was when Sean Spicer was giving briefings and he said, at least Hitler never killed his own people. And I said, Sean, he gassed the Jews. And he goes, ooh, yeah, that's right. And then later he came out and apologized for that. But that is the only time I've ever seen anyone in this administration in the last 3.5 years apologize for anything that Hunter said.
Right. And he did the right thing by apologizing, but that was a flippant remark, right? Yeah. That wasn't a detail that they're trying to hide,
Yeah. But at least that was released.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I could see Kaylee coming out today and going, well, you know, there's no real proof that the U.S. And the president isn't going to comment on that. And we don't want to get ahead of the president on that, which always means they have no idea what to say. They're just wanting to avoid legal entanglements. How many, who was the first president you covered?
Well, you know, I've covered lots of different things. The first president, like covering the absolute, covering the White House was Obama, right? Prior to that though, I mean, when I covered NASA, I would deal with the administration of Bill Clinton, and then with, for a while with George W. Bush when I came back to cover it for after the Columbia accident. So, you know, I don't have that much DC experience, but I have a lot of experience in dealing with the agencies and, you know, from afar. I mean, I've spent 20 years in Florida. So, you know, I've never seen anything like this. You know, I've literally gotten these ridiculous emails from some, you know, 23-year-old junior flack at DHS writing me a Stephen Miller type tirade about my question. And it's a factual question that I ask. You know, there is a factual answer to it. You know, just tell me the damn
just tell, you know,
right? Don't, it's not your job to lecture me on how to do my job.
Yeah, right. Well, that's I got, I've gotten into a, with that on that issue many times. And that was the first time I got into it with Sarah Sanders. And I said, look, any one of us are replaceable. You're here to answer our questions. These are legitimate questions. Just answer the questions. And they it's like Katie Miller, when they came out at the beginning of this coronavirus epidemic, and I had a very simple question, very relevant. Can the uninsured get tested and not have to worry about it? You know, health insurance, if you have, and they wouldn't answer it. And they still can't answer it. They still haven't. I want to go back to something that was said. Were you there when Alex Azar had the very first briefing about the coronavirus? And it was in the Eisenhower office building in the auditorium.
I was not, there, but I do remember the briefing.
Yeah. It was, there were about 100 of us there, and there were three or four people up on stage. And I remember I was talking to Steve Holland from Reuters afterwards. And I said, what'd you think of this briefing, Steve? And he said something to me that chilled me because I'll never forget it. He said, this is the first time I've come out of a briefing feeling worse than going into the briefing. He said, they have no handle on what is going to happen. And that was the day before the first death was announced. And the numbers that Azar gave that day so far have proven to be accurate. And I remember I picked it, you know, I picked a couple of things out of what was said and what they had promised. And what I, for the life of me, can't understand is how you can call it a hoax. And were you there that day on this lawn when he said it's a hoax? And that was actually that same day. Trump left that afternoon to go to a South Carolina rally and called it a hoax on the South lawn. Said it'll be over with soon.
Right. That was like very late in February. And
February 28th, I believe.
Yeah. He went to South Carolina, North Charleston, I think it was. And he said that, you know, this is their latest hoax. This is like their Ukraine impeachment and the Russia hoax. This is their, now they're doing this. And I remember people wrote that story up, and the next day, you know, all the RNC and the campaign, oh, no, no, he didn't say the virus is a hoax. It was the treatment. It's like, you know, guys, well, yeah, come on, man, come on. And this is where we still, and a couple of months ago, he just got bored. The president got bored of dealing with this and he wants to move on. You know, they scheduled a rally in June, right? In June, they scheduled it in a city where the numbers are already increasing. So
I don't, what I've seen.
Where do you even start?
Well, I think your book points out some of that. Very, very well. But I think you can always, with Trump, I think it all boils down to what you said. I think he's bored. I've seen him as low energy lately. He doesn't have the same, you know, energy that he had earlier on in his administration. Even when he's coming out and reading stuff, he reads the same thing over and over again, sticks to the same talking points, much as he did during the RNC. But I take it back to something that he said. I asked him a question. I said, is it your opinion or contention that if people have an opinion contrary to yours, that they should be sued? And he said, well, when they get the opinion totally wrong, as the New York Times did, yes. So I think if there is a second term for this guy, yeah, I think it does not bode well for us or others covering him. What do you think?
Yeah, it's, you know, I guess we're lucky in that, you know, libel suits, et cetera, happen in state courts and not in federal. So there's just all kinds of consequences that Americans need to understand if there's a second term. I mean, he's doing all these things now. He extorted Ukraine to help him win. Okay, that is the word we're looking for. Extortion. If you don't do this for me, I will not give this to you, right? That's what the crime is. It's in the U.S. code. He begged Xi Jinping to help him win the election by buying more stuff. He is openly violating the idea that you don't use public resources for campaign. He's doing it every day, right? He's doing it every day. Every single one of these so-called official events he's going out to, he's campaigning. He starts and immediately jumps into campaign type remarks. What do you think is going to happen when he doesn't have to face any consequence whatsoever in his second term? He never has to face the voters again. What is to restrain him? He's already been impeached and the Republicans refuse to touch him. What's going to happen?
Good question. The bigger question that you bring up is, what do you think the long-term effects of the United States are on our allies and internationally because of him?
Well, you know, I think we have a window to make things right. Because I in the first couple of years, I would talk to ambassadors, military folks from other countries, and they were like, well, we can still talk with our people at our levels, right? We at the staff level, at the directorate level, and things are kind of okay. And in about year two and a half, year three, I got to say, well, you know, one more year of this and we're just gonna wait it out. There's nothing can be done right now. But I do think that he is seen as an aberration, that people around Europe certainly, perhaps the rest of the world, see this as a giant mistake we've made, and that are counting on us to correct it, right? And so a lot depends on what happens in November. It was funny. I went out to cover the NATO meeting, and then the G7 meeting in 2017, and I'd been in Italy on that big sailing trip back when Obama got elected, right? So I wanted to be there then and talk to people in those same places and see what they thought, because they loved Obama. They loved the idea that America would elect someone like Barack Obama. And I remember a bookstore owner in Milan looking at me, he's like, how could you do this? You're the United States of America. Like, you have a responsibility. Yeah, we elected Berlusconi, but we're just Italy. What does it matter what we do? You know, you guys are important.
This when you were in Italy.
This last time was in 2017 when I went to cover the G7 in Sicily a little later. But the time before that was on the sailing trip with my sons. We were in Italy for the winter of 2009-2010. We traveled around quite a bit.
I was in Italy in 2018. My wife and I an extended vacation because I had to get away because it was driving me nuts. And we were in a shop, and it was I can't remember where it was. Florence, I think it was. And we're in a little shop buying a tie. And the guy looked at me and he said, the only thing your president knows is to have a long tie. He stinks other than that. Why did you do this? And for the life of me, I can't understand why we elected him and continue to do what we do with him.
I lost you, and it's probably me, because when I plugged into the hardwire, it was fine. Okay. I lost you at the, you're talking about, you're in the store in Firenze.
Oh, yeah.
Commenting on the tie, yeah.
Yeah, and the guy said, the guy knows how to wear a long tie, and other than that, he's an idiot.
Yeah.
Why'd you do this to us? And right. I was like, I
I got nothing, man. I'm sorry.
I don't know. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. and we are back. Suresh, I guess we're going to close up today. I'd like to ask you a couple of questions. One, what do you want readers to take away from your book? What's the bottom line?
Bottom line is democracy is fragile. It takes work. And we need to be careful about who we put into that office because it matters, and it matters a lot. You know, the analogy I made was the airlines don't pay pilots $200,000 a year to land the planes on sunny days with no wind, right?
Right.
They pay them that much money to land them on for the day that the hydraulics fail, and then they get a bird strike, take out one engine, and then there's a thunderstorm, and they're trying to land in a crosswind. That's the bad day, and that's why, you know, pilots are paid the way they're paid. The same thing with the president.
Are you implying that he can land an airplane on a sunny day with no wind?
I'm implying that the airplane can land itself on a sunny day with no wind, right?
Because I know he couldn't.
Yeah. The point is that you need someone in the Oval Office who deals with the bad day that you can't even imagine, that you haven't even thought about. And that's the job of the president. And I had a lot of folks on the campaign trail saying, I just want to break things. I want someone to go in and, you know, knock over the table. And I want a bull in the china shop and smash things. And the system needs upending. Well, guess what? You got it.
Yeah.
All right. And 185,000 people are dead. So this is a big deal, and it matters, and people ought to, and need to pay attention.
And then the second question, I have to ask this, the blue water sailing. Tell me about that. Is that bringing peace to your life? Is that how you like to spend your time?
Absolutely. You know, sometimes being on passage can be exhausting because, you know, someone has to be up all night. You need to take turns on night watches because you can't leave the boat go, you know, as you're
making, yeah, you don't have autopilot.
Making way. Well, you do have autopilot, but the autopilot doesn't see ships on the horizon. And there's all kinds of things that someone needs to be awake. So it can be just brutally tiring, and it can be the most rewarding thing ever. I remember one night on the way from Bermuda to the Azores, and there was a nice breeze. We were making probably 6-7 knots, but the waves were small, and the moon just started coming out, and there was a crescent moon, and I think it was Jupiter was out, and the waves were relatively small enough that I could still see the reflections of both on the surface of the water going all the way out there. And the Milky Way later on that night, you know, I brought my son, who was only 9 years old at the time, brought him up top in the middle of the night just to take a look, because it was like magic. It was something. And that's, you know, what's one of the things you just, you know, you can't even imagine living on land, that this such a thing is possible, and such a thing is, you know, within one's reach and on this planet. So
I'm in. That sounds like fun to me. I'm there. The other thing I like to ask everybody who's on this show is if you had a chance to ask the President of the United States any question you haven't asked him, and you and I are of a different breed because I've tried to ask him everything that's ever been on my mind. But is there something you'd like to ask him that you haven't, that you think should be covered?
No, you know, because at this point, I understand that he's just going to say nonsense. I mean, this is literally like trying to interview a toddler. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, what he says.
And you know what? And I feel that way walking into the briefing room. It's like I fought so hard to keep my press pass so I could cover this president. And now I'm at the point where, what's the point? I don't feel like I'm going to get an honest answer, or even an answer that makes any sense.
Yeah. You know, this is not normal, right? This is
not
normal. And we as a society need to understand that this is, if we let this become the norm, you know, we should give up and move to nicer places, because this is not going to work. So
you got any place in mind? You're going to sail there probably.
Well, that's the best thing about a sailboat is, you know, pretty much most of the world is within your reach.
How big is your sailboat?
44.
Wow, you have 44. That's big.
It's big until you get into the open ocean, and then it looks
and then
like
it's
nothing.
Small. Yeah, that's.
Yeah.
What's the roughest weather you've ever sailed through?
20-foot seas, 45 knots sustained, which, you know, only lasted a couple of hours. So I, you know, we took care of the boat and then let the boat take care of us, you know, for the rest of the gale. So
you just battened down the hatches, I guess.
Yeah, and then just put the boat in configuration so that you're not really trying to make any distance, because of course it happened with the wind on the nose, so we weren't going to get anywhere useful. So we were just trying to like ride it out and then make up for lost time later.
How do you ride a 20? I mean, you've got to ride headlong into that wave, don't you? 20
foot. Not completely headlong. About 30 degrees is best. You do want to take the wave kind of on the bow. You never want to turn broadside to it.
Oh God.
No. Stern's not bad. I mean, on my boat anyway, stern's not so bad. And if the wind is actually behind you, you can actually make some pretty good good speed.
Yeah. You know? If the wind's at your back coming at you, you could just jet through that.
We actually hit a gale on our way as we got close to Portugal. It was blowing force 8, which is about, 35 to 40 knots, somewhat higher gust. But it was on the quarter. So we were able to kind of roll downhill on the waves, and the wind was keeping the sails filled, and we had like a 200 and some mile day over a 24 hour period, and got around Cabo São Vicente, and all of a sudden the wind was gone and we were, it was quiet again.
Sail across the Atlantic, do you take a northern route so you can stay closer to land, or you just take it straight across?
Yeah, the boat's safer when you're staying away from land. Right. That's the and when I was growing up, I think, I don't want to get out of sight of land. And then as soon as you get a boat and actually start learning more about this, you realize, no, that's the worst place to be, is near land, because you want to be in deep ocean. When the water's shallow, that's where waves break.
Yeah.
So you're way better off when you've got 2 miles of water underneath you than when there's only like 150 feet.
Unless, of course, you can't swim, then.
Well, it doesn't matter anyway. Right.
No, that's true, too. You're gone. Go ahead.
No, it's been my pleasure being on your show, Brian. Thank you so much.
Therese, thank you, and the best of luck on the book, man. I recommend it to everyone and anyone. The name of the book, of course, is The Useful Idiot, and we're not talking about anyone but President Donald Trump. Thanks for joining us on the show. Hope to have you back soon.
I'd love to be back. Thank you.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.